Welcome to Italian Histories. I'm Jordan Bradley, and this is Venice, Episode 3, The First Doges. Last episode, we explored the Venetian Lagoon and the forces that helped give the people a shared cultural, economic, and political identity during the roughly 300 years after the historical founding of Venice. Now, let's talk religion and politics. Much like their geography, the religious power in the lagoon helped shape Venice into something separate from the powers in play in mainland Italy. The Patriarch of Aquileia was historically founded by Saint Mark himself, and was widely considered to be the second most powerful position in the early Catholic Church, after the Bishop of Rome that was founded by St. Peter and was soon known as the Pope. I'm not going to dig into medieval papal power politics here. We'll get there when we go to Rome. But in this early period, the Pope was not yet the Pope, and there were not infrequent challenges to his claims to rule, and high-ranking theological disagreements could cause serious divisions in the Church. After the Patriarch fled from Attila's sack of Aquileia and set up residence in Corrado in 452, the Venetians found themselves with a quasi-independent source of religious power, and after a century, found themselves in schism for the first and definitely not close to the last time with the Roman Church. You can look up the schism of the three chapters if you want to dig into that more, but what matters for our story is that the schism shows that the lagoon had some serious diplomatic clout by the mid-500s. And the schism offered an opportunity for rival factions to claim a new patriarchy in Aquileia, while the old patriarch of Aquileia, now in Corrado, argued that the authority went with the office holder and not the location. The contentions between these competing patriarchal claims will take centuries to resolve, and we'll address them as they come up. But by the early 700s, the schism had been resolved for about 100 years, and the Roman Church recognized both patriarchal claims as legitimate, having created the new title, Patriarch of Grado, for the old Patriarch of Aquileia. Meanwhile, in Byzantium, religious worship had developed to such a degree that numerous areas used icons extensively, which included images and statues painted and carved from all types of materials as objects of adoration and veneration. This type of worship was not happening in Italy like in the eastern reaches of the empire, so when the iconoclast movement gained power in Byzantium, and Emperor Leo III banned the use of icons in 726 and ordered the destruction of all religious imagery, there was unprecedented backlash all over the Italian peninsula. Italy was already severely divided at this time. The Exarchate of Ravenna was the official office of the Byzantine Empire that ruled over Italy and had duchies organized along the Adriatic Sea and through Rome, Campania, Basilicata, and Calabria. The Lombards, the largest and most long-lasting barbarian invasion force Italy ever saw, were conquering most of the inland territories from north of Venice down to the interior lands of modern Puglia. The constant tension between Byzantine forces, Lombard forces, and all these petty tyrants who wanted to rule the duchies was exploited by Pope Gregory now that the Byzantines were questionable temporal protectors and definite religious oppressors. In less than 25 years, the entire Exarch of Ravenna was gutted, Ravenna itself conquered by the Lombards, and other holdings enervated by the Italians themselves, and Byzantium was forced to regroup and reorganize in body. The Venetians, in true Venetian fashion, have two competing historical lines on this series of events. If you look at any Venetian list of doges, the first will be Paolo Lucio Anafesto. Tradition holds that in 697, the Patriarch in Grado called the 12 tribunes of the lagoons together and told them that their factional interests were undermining the long-term interests of the lagoon, and that they must choose one leader. Paolo was selected by the people as doge, and the tradition goes on from there. Paolo served until 717 and was succeeded by Marcello Tagliano. Venice, always free, always popular, always serene. There are paintings, there are sculptures, there are records. Done and dusted. Move along. Nothing to see here. However, as clean as the revisionist history on the list of doges may seem, it doesn't hold up. Norwich goes so far as to say that the first doge, Paolo, was made up, and the second doge, Marcello, was just a Byzantine appointee. I wouldn't go so far as to say that Paolo is made up, but I agree that neither men were the doges the Venetian tradition makes them out to be, and there is a lot of scholarship trying to suss out the details on this. Again, records from this time remain spotty, but what we do know is that while the Byzantines ruled over Italy, Venice was a duchy of the Exarchate of Ravenna. Sometime during this period of the late 600s to 726, there were numerous border disputes between the Byzantines and the Lombards, and the Duke of Treviso on the Lombard side was named Palicio, while his counterpart in border negotiations was Marcellius in Latin, or Marcello in Italian. A record referencing their names and negotiations survives today. And the Exarch of Ravenna at the time of rebellions against Byzantine iconoclasm was Paul, and his Magister Militum, or ranking general who could have had responsibilities of running ducal administration, but has no record of bearing the title of dux or duke in Latin, was Marsilius. And the last name, Tegaliano, does not appear in records for another couple hundred years. The overlap of names is not a coincidence, and the lack of records allows for the revisionist history that Venice has embraced, basically since forever. But I don't emphasize it here to undermine Venice or sow distrust of her history. Venetians, both at the time and for centuries afterwards, were trying to build a political identity, and they recognized the essential nature of history to that identity. And as they develop through the centuries against the forces of Byzantium, Lombardy, Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Empire, the Pope, the Turks, and so many more, the story of their origins and freedom will be essential for them to maintain their freedom, politically, spiritually, and legally. That doesn't change that Paul, the Exarch of Ravenna, was assassinated in 726 in rebellion against Byzantine iconoclasm, and then the people of the Lagoon came together and elected Orso I Pato as Doge. But the Venetians didn't see themselves as a rebellious people, or one that needed to be set free. They saw themselves as free, and massaged the histories to support that claim to freedom. It's easy to judge that post facto, but history is lived in the moment of time, and, I think with the benefit of hindsight, their decisions make sense. And so, 300 years after their historical founding, the Venetians are Roman, but they're not. They're Italian, but they're not. They're Byzantine, but they're not. And they're Catholic, but they're not. And now, with their first proper doge, Orso I Pato, even though he's the third on any list you'll find, the Venetians are ready to make their own way in the world. Now, these early years of the Venetian dogeship, in this unpainted, unstatued, and way more accurate version we're going to see here, were far from serene. Following his election to doge during the uprising against Byzantine iconoclasm throughout Italy, Doge Orso I Pato focused on strengthening the military character of the people and defending the lagoon from Lombard incursions. After Paul, the Exarch of Ravenna, was executed in those uprisings, Ravenna fell to the Lombard king Liutprand. The Pope, who had encouraged, and the Venetians, who found their political freedom in the uprisings, both realized that inviting Lombard conquest was going to end poorly for them. So when the new Exarch, Eutychius, asked for help in retaking Ravenna, the Pope exited stage left, and the Lagoon and her doge answered with 80 ships and helped repel the Lombards. Byzantium rewarded Doge Orso with the title Ipatos, an honorific which the family turned into their surname Ipato, and also served at once to legitimate the doge's rebellion against Byzantine authority and bring the doge back into the Byzantine sphere of power as a subordinate authority. Doge Orso kept the focal point of political power in the lagoon in his native city of Ericlea, in the northeast of the lagoon for 13 years, until he died fighting in what appears to be one of the many instances of Ericlea and Equilum effectively engaging in civil war. It is also entirely possible that his own people killed him in his residence, but the stories that use this death usually point to it as evidence of Venice's long-standing commitment to republican rule and the fear of one man holding so much power. I am personally skeptical about that argument. In all cases, though, he died. After Doge Orso's death in 737, the Byzantine exarch re-exerted authority over the lagoon and appointed a new Magister Militum every year. These officials had some ducal powers to administer the region on behalf of the exarch, and this setup lasted for 5 years until the last appointee, Giovanni Fabricico, also took sides in a civil conflict between Eracle and Equilum and was overthrown, had his eyes gouged out, and was exiled. At this point, in 742, the office of the Doge returns. I can't find an exact account of what happened, and some say the Exarch let Venice reinstitute the Doge, which is somewhat believable because Byzantine power was waning throughout the north of the Italian peninsula and was less than a decade away from permanent expulsion. Some say that the Venetians again threw off their not exactly overbearing overlords to return to the Doge after a brief interregnum, the 5 years of different magister militums. Which is somewhat believable because it's clear from the records we do have that the people of the Lagoon really didn't like being ruled by anyone at this point, and they were definitely ready to fight about it. I think, as with most things, the truth is somewhere in the middle, and the return of the Doge was forced and then diplomatically acknowledged. Again, wherever you come down on this historical debate, what we do know for sure is that Teodato, the son of Orso Ippato, was exiled when his father was killed, was likable enough that he was invited back and soon appointed as Magister Militum for a year during the 5 years of the Magister Militum Interregnum, and then was elected Doge after Fabriciacco was dispatched. Teodato moved the center of political power in the Lagoon from Eraclea to Malamocco. This had a number of positive effects for Venice in the long term. First, it moved the center of government away from the long-standing civil and religious conflicts of the northeast corner of the Lagoon. Second, it moved the political power of the Lagoon to the center of the Lagoon. And third, Malamocco was known for its sympathies to the Republican faction within the Lagoon. To understand the importance of this move, it's helpful to know the main factions and their interests at the time. First, Eraclea, where Orso was from, was sympathetic to the pro-Byzantine faction that wanted to see Venice stay with the Byzantine Empire. Second, there was a Republican faction that wanted to see Venice build toward its own independent state. Third, there was a growing faction that was pro-Frankish and wanted to ally with the new Carolingian dynasty being built on the mainland with full support of the Pope. Lastly, there was a fourth faction, much smaller and short-lived than all the rest, that was pro-Lombard and wanted to join with their Lombard neighbors against all outside and religious claims to rule. The records and treaties of this time already show Venice to be deeply integrated into the economic activities of unloading goods from the Adriatic Sea and moving them across the lagoon and up the rivers. Perceived long-term economic interest had a significant influence on the strengths of the dominant factions. Basically, it mattered where the money was flowing. In addition to factional interest in conflict, there were also consistent efforts to establish a hereditary dynasty over Venice, just as rulers were doing all over Europe during this early medieval period. Fortunately for Venice, both the distribution of faction throughout the lagoon, in contrast to the tighter quarters of a walled city, and her 3.25 factions, served to make jealousy of power a real check on dynastic aspirations. After 13 years of rule, Teodato was deposed, blinded, and exiled by his pro-Frankish successor, Galla Gaulo, who lasted about a year before he was deposed, blinded, and exiled, and succeeded by the pro-Lombard Domenico Monegario. Domenico's reign is notable because the Venetians started electing two annual tribunes to limit the Doge's power, an interesting revision on Rome's practice of electing two annual consuls to wield the executive power. But he chafed under those limits and was deposed, blinded, and exiled after 8 years when he came into open conflict with the Pope and thus the pro-Frankish faction. The election of Maurizio Galbaio finally provided some stability to Venetian politics. Maurizio was pro-Byzantine and as such resisted the Republican faction, but his own personal ambitions required Venice to have some power for herself. Under his rule, development started on the central islands we now call Venice today. And this also brought a new source of power from people who were, in Norwich's summation, quote, tired of bloodshed and longed for a system by which one ruler might quietly succeed another with the minimum disruption of everyday life, and of course, trade, end quote. This is an inescapable political truth that we can now find easily in Aristotle's Politics, but was lost at the time and found its way into early modern Republican political theory through Polybius's and Machiavelli's reframing of Polybius' account of the regime cycle. I'm not going to do a lecture on the regime cycle here, but here's a quick and dirty summary. Without strong institutions to balance against this natural tendency, people get tired of the work of self-government and the inescapable imperfections of any form of popular rule, and they turn to a strong man to sort it out. They trade consent for stability and give submission for peace, until that one ruler invariably stops ruling with justice in mind and rules for his own interest, and the whole cycle of regime change starts spinning again, as the aristocrats chafe at the disrespect and the people fight against the oppression. It creates an endless cycle through the good and bad forms of rule, by the one, the few, and the many, until, as modern republican theory shows, the powers of each group are balanced through strong institutions. At this point, the only institutions Venice has are the Doge, two tribunes, and a mess of foreign forces. And I include the clergy here as a foreign force, exerting far too much force within the regime for it to be truly independent. Maurizio tried to use this institutional imbalance to his advantage by leaning into his relationship with Byzantium, who recognized the value of his position with the title of Ipatos and Magister Militum, and supported the association of his son Giovanni with the ducal title as second doge. This preparation allowed for a simple transition of power after Maurizio's death, but it cut out any electoral power claimed by the Venetians and shifted the basis of rule from consent to hereditary monarchy. Maurizio had prepared for and managed this transition well during his 22 years of rule, and Venice's growth and stability under his rule provided reasons for optimism. In addition to salt, fish, and wages from moving goods inland, the Venetians had found valuable export commodities in lumber and in slaves that, as Lane explains, would be the economic engine not only for the next century, but strengthen Venetian commercial strength and identity for centuries to come. Quote, wood, like slaves, was the essential means of getting foreign exchange, namely gold or silver, from the Muslims, with which to buy from Constantinople the luxury wares so much in demand in the West. Their ready access to supplies of timber stimulated Venetian shipbuilding. Iron and hemp were also to be had relatively cheaply, so that the Venetians built ships both for themselves and for sale for others. Then, having their own ships and having acquired, through the sale of slaves to the Muslims, precious metal to use as capital, the Venetians took into their own hands more and more of the trade between their lagoon and the imperial capital, Constantinople. End quote. Piracy was one of the biggest threats to this expanding economic system, but we'll get into that in later episodes as the 9th century progresses. And the new doge, Giovanni Galbaio, thought it could wait too. His biggest concern was reigning in the Patriarch of Grado. By this time, the Carolingian dynasty was well into its rise, and Charlemagne was consolidating power throughout the Italian peninsula. These Frankish forces provided direct support to the Pope, and were thus the preferred faction of the vast majority of the clergy. The Patriarch's intransigence was first an economic threat. The Church still condoned the slave trade of pagans, heretics, and infidels, but Charlemagne opposed the slave trade altogether and developed a particular dislike over Venice's unprincipled profiteering from the trade, and he leaned on the Pope to apply his ecclesiastical power to persuade the Venetians to stop. In his final year, Doge Maurizio had established a new bishop on one of the islands, Olivio, that will eventually be connected to modern Venice as she grows. And Doge Giovanni sought to fill the position with anti-Frankish proclivities as the threat from the Patriarch grew from an economic one to a regime-level one. But the ruse was too transparent, and the Patriarch of Grado would not give his authorization or blessing to the new cleric, so he could not take the office. Doge Giovanni, not amused, decided the best solution was to send his son, another Maurizio, who he had already elevated to second doge, to Grado to negotiate with the Patriarch. And by negotiate, I mean go medieval on him, and then drag him up to the top of his palace tower and throw him into the square. The brutality of the murder reverberated throughout the lagoon, and would soon ring in more changes for Venice. Next episode, there are coups, then there are coups, and then there are what the French call les incompétents. This episode was researched, written, recorded, and edited by me, Jordan Bradley, and all show notes and transcripts can be found at italianhistories.com. I'm so glad you're here, and I hope you are enjoying it with me. If you'd like to support the show, there's information on how to do so on the Italian Histories website. Thank you so much for sharing this project with your friends and taking the time to leave a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice. This is really the best way to help the show right now. If you have any questions, send me an email at italianhistories@gmail.com and I'll do my best to answer. Until next time, bravi, forza e coraggio. Ciao, ciao.